Space, the final frontier. That's where we're going next. Paul Kinzer, our guest, member of the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, and a longtime amateur astronomer himself. He's the author of the book Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. And if you've got questions about our night skies, our planets, our celestial beings, you can give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. And Paul Kinzer, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, I'm always glad to come.
Yeah, I was telling our last guest, when I look out in the night sky, the one thing that strikes me, and it is very introspective, and it does become very self-centered, is that the one thing out there that I do not see as far as I can look and as far as we've gone is life. It seems to be the rarest thing in the universe.
It seems that way, but I don't believe it's rare, because we now know we've learned so much in the last few decades. We now know that there are planets around other stars. We didn't know that when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s. In fact, we now know that on average, every star has a planet, at least one planet. So there are literally trillions upon trillions of planets in the universe. I can't believe that there isn't somewhere that not only has life, but that has intelligent thinking, making creatures.
Statistically speaking, we are not alone.
Yeah.
The reality of it, however...
Right. We haven't found any yet.
Right. But it's not that we should stop looking, because the statistics would suggest if we keep looking, we will find something eventually. And we have seen indications of water, the components of life, carbon, that it would just take something... I don't know what it would be, the element that makes it all come together to give us what we are right now.
Right. We are not going to find intelligent life on Mars or anywhere else in the solar system. We've explored it enough to know that. However, there are missions in space right now that are going out into the solar system to look for signs of life. This time not on Mars. That was our sort of high hope for the longest time. And it's not a dead hope. We may find, if not life, we may find the remains of life.
Artifacts
on Mars.
Yeah,
fossils. It's possible. I would even say that it's probable, in my opinion, because it's incontrovertible now. There was once liquid water on Mars.
There was an atmosphere there that was thicker than what it stands today.
Yeah, and we have figured out why the atmosphere went away. It went away because of the solar wind, little bits that the sun spits off, and they hit our atmosphere too, but gravity is strong enough here to hold on to our oxygen. I believe it was the probe from India that is, I think, still in orbit around Mars. They were able to see, to this day, parts of the atmosphere of Mars being blown away by solar particles.
Wow.
And it was too small to hold on to that atmosphere.
But we're big enough now where a solar wind isn't going to have anything like that effect.
And then the moons out at Saturn and Jupiter, we are pretty convinced they have vast oceans of liquid water under their frozen surfaces. And they, in fact, some of them are, they have more water than all the water on Earth. And because of the tides created by the giant planets they go around, that's why there is liquid water. The tides cause friction down beneath the surface that keeps things warm. And it may well be that there are things going on them that led to life.
Organisms?
Yeah. And one of the probes we sent out there is going to go through plumes that are being shot out of at least one of the moons, and maybe, in fact, the Cassini probe at Saturn, it did fly through some, and it found some traces of some maybes, but it wasn't sent there back in before the year 2000. It arrived in 2004. It was not designed to zip through the plumes from this moon, because it's the thing that discovered those plumes.
So, I didn't know it was there until it got there.
Yeah. So
it is an
again, it is just an aspirational way to see the world that we're living in, and this understanding that we're statistically speaking probably not alone, even if it feels that way right now.
Right.
Paul Kinzer, in the news recently has been this story of the 3i Atlas comet in the news recently, because NASA had to come out just yesterday and say, this is not a spaceship.
Yeah.
Why did NASA have to come out, release pictures of this comet that is flying near us, and argue that this is not the mothership coming to take us home?
Because there are people who want it to be that. They want it to be the mothership so badly that they look at what evidence we have and they find reasons to claim what they claim. Has to do with the orbit, you know, how could it be zipping through here? The first one, you know, it's called 3i because it stands for third interstellar object. Mm-hmm. Well, the first interstellar object, it's got a name now, I can't remember what it was. It was shaped a lot like, well, maybe a lot like the Millennium Falcon. But
Han Solo come?
Yeah. But so this Harvard professor, his name is Avi Loeb. He wrote a paper and presented arguments about why he thought it was quite suspicious to think of this merely as a passing interstellar rock because of the way it was coming in and the way that it left and things like that. But others were able to quickly come up with arguments and reasons that did not it did not need little people or big people flying a spaceship. And then the second one came and he released another paper, and the third one.
And this is the third one now.
This is the third one now. And he made that claim. And the thing is,
This is a Harvard astronomer.
Yeah.
And I am not even a backyard astronomer.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't I buy what Avi Loeb is selling?
Well, and in your last hour, I think a big part of it is the times we live in and the technology we have.
Yes.
And one of those technologies is the internet. And so if he had made these claims 25, 30 years ago, it would not have reached nearly as wide an audience as it has. It might make the media, but it wouldn't be the thing it is now, because there are people who really, really want this. And there are, all the media, they're like, ooh, this is a good story.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, hey, he's at Harvard and all that.
Right,
so,
there's credibility there. He's Ivy League.
Yeah.
And yet the NASA has been pretty insistent that this is just a comet that is coming nearby.
Yeah.
And we have improved our opportunities, abilities to actually see these nearby comets.
That's right. Now, the other thing is, it didn't come very close to Earth. We weren't able to get great pictures of it. In fact, one of our orbiters at Mars took pictures of it, mm-hmm. which to me is pretty cool. You know, there are a lot of science fiction writers and speculative people who say when things from other stars do arrive, or if they ever do, they will probably be robots. Because, you know, look at that orbiter on Mars. It doesn't need air. It doesn't, you know, it's just a thing that someone built. We built it, and it could just, you know, it's made for taking pictures of the Martian surface. They just have a turn around. Hey, there's a comet there. Take some pictures. I found that amazing. That's
so
pretty cool to me.
When we get to the possibility of other life coming to Earth, if we apply our own technology to that, it's likely that what we'll see first is machines, equally likely that we will mistake them for the actual aliens.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm not going out on that big a limb. Most really serious scientists would say the whole idea that we have been visited and are still being visited by anything from another star is very unlikely because of the speed of light.
Mm-hmm. That's like sort of a universal speed limit. That's about as fast as we can go. And when we're 500 to 1,000 light years away from something, that's going to take us 500 to 1,000 years to get there.
If we could ever get near the speed of light, which would be extremely difficult for, I won't go into the reasons because I don't quite understand relativity.
Right? Neither did Einstein, so you're not alone.
Yeah, but it is a very difficult thing. I think another cool thing is, though, people have thought of ways that we could create ships, spaceships, that could get to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, in, you know, anywhere from 100 years down to 10 or 12 with kind of current technology. However, one of those is to take a whole bunch of atomic bombs and let them out the back of the ship and blow them up to push the ship.
And your have a propulsion big... system is just...
Yeah, yeah. And
nuclear reactions?
Somebody came up with that in the 60s, I think kind of as a joke. But it's been studied a lot, and it would work.
Interesting. Yeah. As we look for life out there and the life that is here in our backyard, take your questions now with our guest, Paul Kinzer from the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, author of Stargazing Basics. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Marcus in Green Bay now. Marcus, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's my understanding that there are satellites that can be controlled. They can be stationary instead of orbiting. I don't mean Starlink. So is that correct that, you know, some satellites can be moved to a place and remain stationary over the
Yes, not only that, they're extremely important satellites. That's where we get all of our, international news coverage and stuff. And they are in orbit, but they're at a place. And I'm not an orbital dynamicist, but these satellites are in a place far enough from Earth so that as they orbit the Earth, they go around the Earth in the same amount of time it takes the Earth to spin around once. It's called geostationary orbit. It's sometimes called the Clark orbit because science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke thought of it during World War II, before we had any idea that we were going to soon be up in space, and he lived to see communication satellites in that orbit.
These satellites have become part, at least in my experience, of our night sky viewing, Paul,
yeah.
And they have become tracers in the sky.
Yeah.
They have become, to some, congestion
yeah.
in the night sky.
Yeah, and those are not the geostationary ones. They're so far away and so small that unless you're taking an astro image of a very specific part of the sky, you're not going to see those. But there are now thousands upon thousands of low Earth orbit satellites. They need to go much more quickly. They need to go at least 17,000 miles an hour, or they'll fall back down to Earth. And when they do that, and they're up there, they're where the International Space Station is, they're where a lot of scientific satellites are. And what most of these are now, they're being launched here in the United States, they're being launched by SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, to allow people to communicate via the internet and cell phone all around the world. Now, I got in an argument a while ago with a guy where I said, I don't think we need these. We're fine without them. And he said, no, latency, the not tendency, but the lag of mm-hmm. a signal being sent in the ways that we send them now are too long, and that people won't stand for them when they now know they don't need them. And I'm like, you know what? Almost no one's using these. So I don't buy it. I think there are more reasons to not do it than to do it. And again, there are people who don't agree with me, and that's up to them. But the other thing is, there's no regulation because he's not the only one doing it. There are other companies doing it. Jeff Bezos wants to do it. China is doing it. They're sending up thousands of satellites. There's a company in the UK that's doing it or hoping to do it. And it isn't just the satellites. The rocket launches themselves are leaving a lot of little bits of not nice stuff in the upper atmosphere, and nobody knows what that's going to do. Nobody is even looking at it seriously.
Well, you said would it have to keep going at 17,000 miles an hour or re-enter the atmosphere, burn
right.
up, or
and
crash?
They eventually do re-enter the atmosphere, and to give them credit, SpaceX has planned for that, and they try to take care to make sure that those are not harmful to humans by hitting the ground. But all of these satellites, when they hit the atmosphere, they have heavy metals in them and other things. Even aluminum little tiny bits of it getting in the atmosphere. There are scientists who are worried this may affect the atmosphere. And I'm not, again, I'm no expert. It's just, I think it's one of those things we're going into without thinking of the consequences strongly enough.
That maybe we should be thinking a little bit more about what's in our night skies before we just go ahead and put them up there.
Yeah. Well, astronomers are definitely not happy. We have several very large telescopes coming online soon, and this will affect their science. One of them is called the Vera Rubin telescope, named for a very important astronomer. Look her up. And it is a survey telescope that is the technology that makes it especially amazing is its data processing, because every stinking night it's going to be taking pictures, very detailed pictures of huge swaths of sky every few seconds. It's going to be creating petabytes of
I don't even know what that is.
I can't remember.
Stop
either,
the terabytes.
Terabytes. petabytes, I think, is 1,000 terabytes. And it's going to be creating those. And they had to figure out, well, how do we even get that information onto some kind of storage device? And then how do we disseminate it? Anyway, that telescope is going to see all of these satellites every night. And they'll be able to come up with ways of subtracting that information. But it's not nice.
It's not still interference.
Thing. Yeah.
Where is this telescope going?
Thanks.
Sorry.
I believe it's one of the ones in the Atacama Desert, like that 7-ton telescope you talked about. Yeah. I believe it's in South America. And that's a great place for telescopes because it's so high and it's so dry. There's no rain there. But it's already taken some pictures, and in it, in its first few pictures, it discovered a bunch of asteroids.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No.
So we are already, this new telescope's already producing results in terms
of... It's in testing phase.
Would these be near-Earth asteroids?
Well, that's one of the things it's looking for.
Interesting.
But anything bright enough, it's going to see it.
So could the space junk, could the proliferation of satellites in our lower Earth orbit, could that get in the way of our opportunity to identify approaching celestial objects?
There are astronauts who are now saying it could soon get in the way of us even going up there. They just had to, China has its own space station. And they just had to either have the crew leave early or make them stay longer because they knew they were going to go through some space debris. They had to take evasive action.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and the International Space Station, they have systems for that too. When they know, uh-oh, we're going near here, let's boost our orbit a little bit or go a little bit lower for a little bit or whatever. There's a lot of stuff up there. And I can't remember the term, but there was a scientist who came up with if we reach this certain point and then of how many we have up there, and then one of them hits another, it could lead to a cascading effect of all sorts of them hitting each other. And then it could be years and years before we would be able to launch a rocket into space.
Space again, dominoes.
Yeah. And I don't know how realistic that is, but it's definitely being taken seriously.
Paul Kinzer, our guest, member of the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, author of the book Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, and here to answer your celestial questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us, talk@wpr.org. And when we continue, we'll take a look at the Aurora Borealis, which stretched all the way to Alabama last week. Are we seeing more of these sun storms? That's when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Did you get your WPR newsletter today? We only send it once a day, and by we, I mean our own Jenny Peek. You're never going to miss a story with a WPR daily newsletter. We're not going to bug you about it, but it's there for you each and every morning when you sign up at WPR.org/newsletters. It'll keep you informed and connected with stories you need to know and people you're going to want to meet. So sign up today at WPR.org/newsletters. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show, our guest Paul Paul Kinzer as we look to the night skies and the celestial happenings out there and what it means for us back here at home. If you have astronomical questions, you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Paul, I heard that the Northern Lights reached all the way to Alabama last week. However, I did not see them. Did you?
I did. Members of my club wrote an email that night, and I just happened to be on the line at time, and someone just wrote, Northern Lights, now.
So, enough said.
Yeah, my wife and my son and I, we went into our backyard in our little town, and there they were. And we hadn't even had our eyes adjust to the darkness yet. If we had stayed out longer, we would have seen them much better. But, yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. And so what is it that made these lights go all the way to the southern states of the United States?
Well, the sun is a mass of incandescent gas. that's an old song. But it's very active. It you know, it's what gives us life on Earth, basically, the heat from it. I'm not going to go into all the science, but there are storms on the sun, not like rainstorms here on Earth, but magnetic storms where bits of the sun can get blown off the surface. And sometimes it's aimed at Earth when that happens.
Is this what happened to the atmosphere in Mars? Was it a solar storm that created the solar wind that blew the atmosphere off Mars?
It's part, the sun is always putting out bits of particles, and we call that the solar wind, because like blowing air, it is blowing bits. It's tiny, but it is enough over, you know, years and centuries and millions of years to do just that. And it wasn't necessarily solar storms that did it to Mars. It was just the constant, and still is, the constant bombardment of these little particles that is still eroding Mars's very thin now atmosphere. And it didn't happen here. Well, it did happen here. We probably used to have way more hydrogen on Earth. Maybe, I don't know. But our gravity isn't really strong enough to hold on to helium. If you pop a helium balloon, the helium in it, it's going to space. Anyway, the sun has these storms, and it also has an 11-year cycle where every 11 years it reaches a peak. And if you use a telescope to look at the sun, always with the filter, of course, you can see spots on it. And a lot of people think, why are there dark spots on the sun? And I always have to say, they're not dark. They're just not as bright as the stuff around them. They're still very bright, but they look dark compared to everything else. Those spots are where the storms are going on and where the stuff might get spit out. And every 11 years, we reach a time when there are spots on the sun every day. But then five and a half years later, the sun's surface can go for months with no spots on it.
So where are we in this 11-year cycle right now?
This is a weird one. It wasn't as steady. And the peak, we are in the peak, and it's lasted longer than they typically do. And most people thought we were on our way out, and then we've had these major bursts lately. And they can happen at any time, and they can be bad. They harm satellites. There's a website called spaceweather.com, which if you go to it, it's got a lot of current information about what's going on up above the Earth. And, we can have these solar storms anytime, and there are even satellites up there now that can go into safe mode, and even the International Space Station and stuff with that solar storm last week.
Yeah.
They had to, I believe, the Russian astronauts on it, they moved them to a different part of it just to give them more protection from the radiation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Let's go to your questions now with our guest, Paul Kinzer, longtime amateur astronomer and author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Let's start with Clint and Nina. Good afternoon.
Hi. I was actually calling in because I had seen some terminology thrown around for some of these objects that are passing through our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd seen them calling them interstellar interlopers.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess my problem with that is it makes it sound as though we or our star somehow owns the space we exist in.
Yeah, yeah. Interloper.
Like interloper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it. I am more conscious of this, but when people anthropomorphize not just scientific objects, but science itself sometimes, so when they say, like, evolution invented, evolution doesn't have, it doesn't have agency, it doesn't invent things, or this species figured out a way. No.
Yeah,
I agree with you. Interloper is a bad one. They are interstellar, but it's not like they're going, I'm coming in anyway. I agree with you.
What's a better way to think about that, Paul?
Just interstellar object.
As we are all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
we are sort of flowing through this thing, and sometimes...
Maybe a non-solar object, because everything that is part of the solar system is part of the solar system because of the gravity of the sun and the fact that we pretty much all formed together 4.5 billion years ago. So something coming from somewhere else is really exciting, but the exciting part of it isn't, ooh, is it aliens? It's we've never seen these things before. Does it have the same amount of elements in the same proportions as asteroids in the solar system? And if it doesn't, why? You know, that's cool. And we're going to be able to study that in the coming years as we develop even more the technology we have. I mean, this thing was found by, it's called ATLAS because it was found by a robotic telescope that's scanning the skies looking for things. Used to be comets were all found by humans looking through telescopes.
Right.
That almost never happens now because one of these robotic telescopes spots it first.
So when you see a comet, Halley gets to name the comet, but when the telescope finds it, the telescope gets the name.
Exactly.
Hence 3i Atlas.
Yeah, that's right.
Makes a lot of sense. Clint, thank you for the call. We'll go to Lynn in Westby next. Lynn, good afternoon.
Hi. I was listening to your first part of your program and about settling on Mars. Isn't that a very harsh environment? How could we at all consider that we could settle there?
And yet there is a lot of focus and funding for the possibility of colonizing Mars, Paul.
Yeah. I say this, but I didn't say it first. You want to settle Mars, first try settling Antarctica. Try finding a way to live on Antarctica, not supplied by airplanes coming in every few weeks, but on your own. It'd be way easier because it's right there. It's way close. You can get there in a couple hours. And you can breathe the air. There is no air on Mars. The Martian surface would kill you very quickly. And I, as a kid, I grew up at that time. I was born when lots of scientists still hoped. They didn't really believe it, but they thought, you know, even Carl Sagan, he's like, we need to go to Mars just to know. And then when the satellite sent back pictures of huge asteroid craters, everyone who knew science went, well, there can't be advanced life on a planet that's covered with those because the atmosphere like ours would have washed them away. And they were, no way. But I grew up in that time when we still thought that. Well, we don't think that anymore. And yet some people don't want to let go of their dreams. And unfortunately, I think there are a lot of people who have this idea that, oh, if only I could go live on Mars, I could get away from all the problems on Earth. Well,
if you bring any people with you, I'm afraid you might be bringing the problems with you. We happen to be central to the issues.
Yes. So I think it's, in my own opinion, it's ridiculous. But
what about the aspirational aspect? And that's something we talked about last hour, that it may be ridiculous, but it also may lead to the next generation and something that would be fathomable and not so out of bounds.
Yes, I totally see that. Again, I loved science fiction. Nobody wants to live in the world of Star Trek more than me. But, getting to another star is a whole nother thing, and there are people aspiring to do that. And there, the speed of light gets in your way. But then there are people, theoretical scientists, go, well, there might be ways around that. And they talk about them. And that leads not just maybe someday to Star Trek. It leads to new understanding of how the universe works. So, yeah, there's often unforeseen benefits from these kinds of aspirations. I would just like us to have, because there are so many real things we can aspire to, and those aren't necessarily getting the funding they ought to. They're, you know,
or the focus.
Right. Why is NASA pushing so hard to go to Mars with humans? That's a legitimate question. If you said to me, Paul, will you get to go? I go, okay, then go. Let's do it. Yeah, I'll do that. I'd love to go to Mars. I'd love to go to the moon. I always have wanted to because it would be cool.
Yes.
But long term, if we're talking about getting minerals, then we should be going to asteroids because we don't have to worry about gravity. We don't have to worry about getting up and down from the place.
So if we were to mine something, it wouldn't be the moon or Mars.
No.
It would more likely be an asteroid.
Yeah, and this might get more attention soon because there is actually a NASA probe right now. It's called Psyche. There's an asteroid called Psyche, and we believe it's mostly made of metal.
Hmm.
Most of them are rock or primarily rock. This one, because it's clearly really massive for how big it is, most people think it's mostly made of metal. That probe is going to get there in a few years, and maybe we will go, holy moly, I don't know. It's made of solid gold. No, it won't be that, but there could
rare
be.
Rare earth metals have become a central topic of international debate, foreign trade and policy. And if we had a big asteroid that was just all rare earth metals, it would change the debate here on Earth pretty quickly.
And people have talked about this for decades. You know, and then other people will go, oh, how could you mine an asteroid hundreds of millions
Great
of miles
question.
Away?
Great question.
With nuclear bombs, knock a chunk off and then have that chunk push it towards the Earth and put it in orbit.
Carefully.
Yeah. Well, and that gets into stuff too. But yeah, I mean, these ideas, I think, are more sensible.
I love it. I've got an email here from John in Eau Claire, speaking of our interstellar interlopers. He wants to know where comets get their energy from and how they're able to travel long distances through space.
We believe that most comets that come to Earth come from a thing called the Oort cloud, O-O-R-T, named for a scientist, that was his last name, who he predicted, and evidence since then seems to show that he was right, that there, when the solar system formed, the sun blew away a lot of the dust and small things that are in our inner solar system, and that way out away from the sun, but still kind of part of the solar system because the sun's gravity is what's holding it there, is this huge, way bigger than the part of the solar system we live in, cloud of comets.
The Oort cloud.
The Oort cloud. And every once in a while, who knows, some kind of ripple goes through that cloud. One comet pushes too near another one, and the sun's gravity just grabs it. And then probably thousands of years later, the closer it gets to the sun, the faster it goes, and zing, it comes through. And how it comes through, the path it follows, scientists are able to figure out that path, and they can figure out how far away did that thing come from. Did it come from way out in the solar system? Or like these three objects we found, did it come from another star? And that path is what has shown them, these three things, they're not from here.
Michael emailed to say that for the sake of any life on other planets, he hopes we never find them.
Well, NASA is being extremely careful on any probe now that's going anywhere where they think there's even the tiniest chance of life.
Really?
To really sterilize them. And they didn't do that all the time.
So that we don't end up giving smallpox to another planet.
Well, or wiping out everything there with our own bacteria. Or later coming and going, look, we found life, when it turns out, no, that's life from Earth.
Michael goes on to say, what was one of the first things we did on the moon? We littered.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Our guest is Paul Kinzer from the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, author of Stargazing Basics, and answering your interstellar questions today at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Our conversation continues. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we take a look at what your plants need to prepare for winter with Diana Alfith, retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. And we'll also meet the man who wrote the book on the chainsaw. James Carr joins us with looks at his new book, Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. All coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. Garden Talk every Friday from 11 to 1 here on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest is Paul Kinzer, amateur astronomer extraordinaire, and we've been taking a look at our night skies and what we can see out there. And Paul, you were just mentioning to me that if there is life on our moon, it may be because one nation actually accidentally put it there.
That's right. A couple of years ago, Israel, they aspire to have a space program, and there's national pride involved, and lots of nations now, because we can make smaller robotic landers. Not too expensively. I mean, Apollo cost gazillions of dollars, and now we can do it for only one gazillion or whatever. But they sent a probe there, and it was their first. But on board that probe, they had some tardigrades. And if you don't know what they are, they're sometimes called moss pigs or water bears.
These little microscopic.
They can get up to a millimeter across. So some of them you can actually see with your naked eye. But they're fascinating. Look them up. In fact, the screensaver, if we need those anymore, on my laptop at home, it's a tardigrade. They're very, very interesting.
You've seen them before. I know most folks have seen the pictures of them. They just wouldn't realize that that's a microscopic little being and is now on the moon.
Yeah, because what happened was these little tiny critters, they sent them there, and they were going to study them. But unfortunately, their spaceship crashed. And we don't know. It may be that the tardigrades burned up, but tardigrades go into stasis. They go into a sort of suspended animation, and they put some of them on the outside of the International Space Station for quite a long time. They took them back in. They poured some water on them. They went, "Hey, how's it going?"
And they're back.
They're back. So, yeah,
there might be life on the moon right now.
And it's got eight legs, and each of those legs have really sharp little claws on them. And
they're going to be hard to find.
They look like something somebody made up. Yeah.
And yet it's a very real story of Israel's trip to the moon and the tardigrades that are now potentially there. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of emails I want to make sure we get to. Todd in Sauk City couldn't stay with us. He said that at the school where he used to teach, he and his students would spread a plastic sheet on the roof of the school and leave it there all year. The students would then examine the sheet and find micrometeorite material that settled on it. Paul, have you heard of an experiment like this? Could any of us do this?
Yes, and you don't need to put a sheet on your roof. If you have a roof and it has gutters, that your roof slowly, everything washes down.
Yeah.
And if you take some of that stuff from the gutter, and you know what you're doing, you look under a microscope, yep. And it all started because there was some fellow, I don't think he was a scientist, and he said, "I think this is true." And he said, "I want to see if that's true."
He's got a hypothesis. He tests a hypothesis. It's a scientific method.
Right. We know that the Earth is bombarded with micrometeorites every second, all the time. And he was scoffed at by local researchers, I think. So he did some and took them to somebody who would know what they were doing. They looked in a microscope, and about 10% of that, micrometeorites.
Paul Kinzer, are you telling me that there is stardust in my gutters?
Yes, and and it's also true that you are stardust. All the iron and things like that in our bodies, the only way to create them is in a supernova.
Well,
so the iron in your body was once inside a star.
Now you're making me think it's we who are the aliens,
yeah,
Paul.
Yeah.
Let's go to Gary in Strum this afternoon. Gary, good afternoon.
My question is that we know the sun is what makes the Earth happen. How far out does the sun have enough power to make that happen on another planet?
Interesting, because we talked about the water on Saturn's moons.
Yeah.
But does the sun have the ability to create life on other planets or moons?
Well, the heat of the sun, the radiation of the sun could provide the energy needed for living things. But I took the question a little wider. The influence of the sun with that solar wind, and then with its gravity. Gravity, you know, it fades and fades and fades. I mean, you could say this: the gravity of the sun affects things across the universe, I guess. But the Voyager probes that were sent up in the 1970s, people said they're one day going to reach the edge of the solar system. And it's like, well, that depends on what you mean by the edge. But one definition is when you get so far out that that solar wind is pushed back by the interstellar cosmic radiation.
Oh.
And one of them has reached that point.
Oh.
And it's far away. It's much, much farther than Pluto. So, yeah. And we know there are asteroids that go out way farther than Pluto, like 40, 50 times farther. But then thousands of years later, they come zipping back in their orbits around. Comets do that too. But yeah, so
I hear you counting Pluto as a planet.
Oh, yeah, Pluto's a planet.
If you say
I got Neil deGrasse Tyson to admit that. I talked to him on the phone, and he said, okay, fine, it's a planet, but it's a dwarf planet. And I'm like,
put a caveat at the end of
if it.
It has been up for debate, hasn't it?
Yeah. And if it goes around the sun and it's big enough that gravity made it round, it's a planet.
There you
go. I mean, that is the definition many, many people use, and the argument that it's not a planet. You know, then is Earth a planet because it's so much smaller than Jupiter? I don't know.
I Gary, does that help answer your question?
It does. Hey. So why wouldn't they look for another sun?
Yeah. We do look for other suns, though, don't we? We look for the third rock from the sun on stars all over
galaxy. We have found planets now around, confirmed planets around at least 5,000 other stars. And we can do that now because our telescopes and computers are sensitive enough to see the star wobble. When a planet, like when Jupiter goes around the sun, it makes the sun wobble.
Because of its gravitational force.
That's right. And we have found thousands of them.
Wow. You mentioned the Voyager. Tim up north called to ask if we have received any knowledge. Are we receiving any useful info from the Voyager these days that could help us advance space travel?
I don't know about the advanced space travel other than, you know, they're still able to signal back.
Yeah.
They're still able to stay in touch with them. So that right there is important. How far out can we easily communicate with spacecraft?
Mm-hmm.
And those spacecraft, you know, they're a lot of it is 1960s technology because they were launched in the mid-1970s. I mean, they have tape recorders on them.
Commodore 64 is up in space.
That's probably more advanced than they were or close.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, Paul Kinzer, as we're wrapping up here, what can we see in our night skies coming up here? What should we be looking for across Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's kind of cool. We've taken this long to get to that. That's usually what I talk about the most. Well, the nights are long now. You can go outside right after supper, and it's dark. It's cold, too, but, you know, it's dark.
But that makes the skies clear, doesn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. So I'll just talk a little bit about what's up in the sky in the winter, because, you know, you might not be able to go out tonight. Saturn, if you go outside right when it gets dark, look in the east, and you'll see a fairly bright yellowish star. But if you aim a telescope at it, you'll see that it's shaped like a ball. No star, even in the biggest telescope, is anything more than a point of light. Well, okay, there's a couple of stars that in the biggest telescopes might, but... So it's a little ball, and there's a line going through it, just this little line. Well, that's Saturn, and much of the time, you can see an oval ring going around it. But right now, it's at a place in its orbit where the rings have closed up. They open up over 15 years as the seasons go by, because just like the Earth, it's tilted. So as it goes around the sun, to us, they open up. And then they close after 15 years, but then they open up the other way because Saturn takes about 30 years to go around the sun.
Ooh.
You can also see one of its moons through a small telescope, not binoculars, but a small telescope. That moon is Titan, and NASA landed a European satellite on that moon in 2004 called Huygens. And Huygens was a European scientist hundreds of years ago. And it parachuted through the thick atmosphere of that moon, thicker than Earth's atmosphere. Not oxygen, though. It's natural gas, basically, I think. And it landed. And Cassini itself, the satellite, that the probe that it came off of, took pictures over decades of that moon, and there are seas, lakes, rivers. But again, it's not water. It's frozen natural gas or something. And there's now a plan to send a helicopter there.
A helicopter?
Yeah, because they can fly. This moon has way less gravity than Earth and a thicker atmosphere.
Sure.
So if you can make a helicopter fly on Mars, which they did, whose atmosphere is only 1% of Earth's, well, it's pretty darn easy to get it to fly on a moon that is smaller than Mars and has an atmosphere thicker than Earth. I can't wait for that.
And so we can see Saturn in our skies today.
Yes. And if you wait a little later at night or a little later in the season, Jupiter will be rising.
Whoa.
Jupiter right now, it's coming up. Let's see. Yeah, it's coming up around 8:30 right now. It's rising, so by 9:30.
Nice and dark at 8:30.
9:30, you can't mistake Jupiter. It'll be the brightest thing in the sky.
And again, it'll be a ball.
Yeah, if you through binoculars, you can see the ball of Jupiter and four of its moons.
What?
And there are probes on their way to those four moons right now.
Where in the sky will I be looking for Saturn and Jupiter?
Right now, Saturn is pretty much in the south, right when
south?
It gets dark.
Okay.
And it's maybe, you know, hold both your fists out at arm's length and then do it again.
Okay.
And that's probably where it'll be.
Okay.
And Jupiter, just look in the east. If you have a clear horizon, 8:30, but if you don't, 9:30, 10 o'clock.
Any meteor showers coming our way?
Yes, the Geminid meteor shower, one of the most dependable of the year. You might see 120 meteors in an hour.
Oh.
And that is peaking on, let me look at my notes here. I don't want to make a mistake.
Is this an annual event?
Yes, every December, mid-December, and this year it's the night of the 13th and the 14th. We pass through the debris left by a comet. And as we pass through that debris, the little bits of stuff the comet left behind slam into the Earth's atmosphere. Almost all meteors you see are grains of sand. If you see a super bright one, it might be, you know, a small pebble. Now, there was one about as big as, a bread box that blew up over Viroqua maybe 10 years ago now. People heard it blow up.
But it was just a bread box.
Yeah, well, there was one that blew up over a city in Russia in 2013 about the size of a school bus. If it had been coming in at a steep angle, it might have killed 1 million people.
Whoa.
But because it came in at a narrow angle, it blew up in the upper atmosphere.
Right.
It knocked out thousands of windows.
But most of them burn off in the
atmosphere.
Yeah,
they're just
little
things.
Most of them are smaller than a bread box.
Right, and they zip through in a second. Yeah. And so that's a great night to go out. And this year especially, because this year there's no moon in the sky.
December 13th and 14th?
Yeah, no moon. So if it's clear out, and especially if you can get away from town, you don't want binoculars or a telescope because you don't know where they're going to be in
right?
the sky. And they come out of Gemini. They look like they're coming out of the constellation Gemini, which is where Jupiter is.
Oh!
Yeah, it's pretty cool this year.
All coming up December 13th and 14th in your night skies across Wisconsin.
And the shower starts before then. You're more likely to see way more meteors a few nights before and after as well.
Oh, man. Something to look forward to in our night skies. And Paul Kinzer, it is always a pleasure. You make us see the world a little bit differently. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, I love coming.
It's been fun. Paul's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, also a longtime member of the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society, and he shall return with us here on the Larry Mueller Show. A big thanks to the team that makes it all possible, makes it fun and easy for me. Thanks to Clara Neipert, Joel Patinaw, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and of course, our own Larry Mueller. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Stay tuned. Lots more in store here on WPR News.
is a mass of incandescent gas.